But we are again in chapter 24 of Genesis, and hopefully today we will finish looking at this story of the effort to find a wife for Isaac, the kind of the climax of the servant's search for a wife for his master's son. And today we're going to look at verse 49 or 50 through the end of the chapter. But last week we were looking at the middle of the chapter, and we were looking at the events that occurred there in Laban's house when the servant arrived at Laban's house, and the things that went on there. So put your thinking caps on and go back and what do you remember from our discussion last week?
It's almost a rerun from the week before.
Okay, it's kind of a rerun, wasn't it? Why is that?
Make sure the details are remembered.
Okay.
It's also a lot different from here in the oral culture where you're passing the story down verbally.
Okay.
You tell the story to set it up, and then you tell it again or some.
It embeds it in the memory, doesn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's kind of like repeating things.
Yeah. So it is important. It serves a purpose also, as he repeats the story this time. It serves the purpose of kind of changing the context. First, we're just reading about what happened, and we go, okay, this is what happened, and it's pretty exciting when we read about it. But this time, when he's repeating it, he's repeating it in what context? I'm speaking of the narrator here. The narrator is repeating as he recounts what the servant says. What's the context?
It happened.
Okay, it's already happened. Where is it?
There's a group of new listeners who have never heard the story.
Okay.
Didn't know anything about it.
Okay.
And it kind of reminds me, this side issue, when somebody tells a joke, and the hearer thinks it's funny, many times they'll hear and repeat back part of that joke, and then they'll laugh again.
Uh-huh.
It kind of reminds me of this, you get the story, and then you do it, hear it all again, and then you relive it and think of it.
But, yeah.
And that the question you just asked, all these folks, Laban and the fool and
right.
Rebecca and servants and whoever else,
mm-hmm.
were hearing it for the first time.
Yeah.
So they didn't know his prayer. They didn't know what the servant prayed or anything about what Rebecca did. And so they're learning all about, Laban's learning about his sister, the father's learning about his daughter over
there. And that's, to me, one of the exciting features of this chapter, and one reason I particularly enjoy it, because first we're just told what happens. The narrator just tells the story. Then he tells the story of the servant telling the story. Okay, and that's what we're referring to. If you weren't with us last week, that's what we're referring to. We're referring to the servant actually telling the story then in Laban's house. And what it does is it allows us to put ourselves in the place of these people who are hearing this now for the first time. They weren't out at the well. They didn't see what happened. They didn't know what the servant had prayed in the quietness of his own heart. And so now they're hearing this for the first time. And it's, in particular, I like to focus on Rebecca. Here's Rebecca. She didn't know what the servant prayed. She knows what she did, but she didn't know what the servant prayed. And then as he tells the story, you just get this, if you kind of put yourself in Rebecca's place, you feel the chills going down your spine as you think about, wow, those things I did, they were an answer to this guy's prayer. And she sees her life then in the context of God's direction and God's moving and God's orchestrating the events of her life when she was even totally unaware of it. That's pretty exciting stuff for Rebecca, who's never encountered this God Yahweh before.
So, sure, it seems it's an answer to prayer, but it's not truly been answered yet.
It's not fully answered, is it? Yeah. And it'll get a little dicey here for a few minutes until some things get resolved in today's lesson. But he's just, he expects that God is answering. He expects that God is leading. But he's not taking anything for granted, is he? So he's still waiting for the final confirmation. What else from last week's lesson? Okay. Yeah, it's Laban's taking care of the details. Bethuel's only really mentioned as a participant one time, and that'll be in today's lesson. And so we get the idea that Bethuel is apparently either aged, quite aged, or in some way incapacitated. So he's really not able to participate on a major level. Apparently the major responsibilities for the family and for the decisions of the family have been now transferred to his son Laban, who is Rebekah's brother. And so he's kind of in charge. And again, that's what we'll encounter today as we go through the story.
There's something I kind of wondered about. There's nowhere that it says it, but I'm just kind of wondering about how this could have actually happened. Down in verse 39, where he says, so the servant's repeating this whole story, and he says, suppose the woman doesn't go with me. He didn't really have to tell all that part, but I'm wondering if he's kind of setting up the family and setting up Rebecca to kind of start thinking about it.
I think absolutely that's what he's doing. He's kind of giving them a little bit of a forewarning here. In a few moments, I'm going to throw the ball to your court. And you need to be ready to answer. Okay, which is what he did. And that actually is in verse 49, which I had intended to get to last week, and we just didn't get that far. It was the last verse of the passage that we were looking at last week. And that's exactly what the servant does then at the end. After he's finished telling the story, then he says, so now, if you're going to deal kindly and truly with your master, tell me, and if not, let me know that I may turn to the right hand or to the left. And so at this point, he kind of passes the ball over to them, and it's now their responsibility. And what we're dealing with here with the servant is we're dealing with the servant as he's trying to discern the will of God in the context of providence, okay? And what I mean by that is there are many times in Scripture when somebody is trying to carry out things according to God's will or whatever, and God's will is explicitly stated. God has said, this is my will and this is what I intend to do, and we have direct confirmation from God. So, for example, when Abraham is wrestling with the issues about his wife's barrenness and whether or not he's going to have a descendant, he has a direct, clear expression from God. God has articulated to him openly and specifically what his will is, and so Abraham is responsible to act according to that, according to what God has said, which is why the whole situation with Hagar was so ugly and really was out of God's will, and Abraham should have known better because he had some instruction from God and he had direction from God. He knew what he should expect. But when we get into the context of providence, we have a different situation, because in providence, it's God directing through circumstances, and we don't have his expressed will articulated. So we don't know exactly what God is planning. We don't know exactly what God's intentions are. And so when we're dealing in the realm of God's providence, we have to walk a little more carefully. We have to walk without presumption. So the servant is each step of the way. What he does know is he does know that God has made a covenant promise to his master, and he knows God's promises to Abraham, and so he knows God does care and that God is going to direct and God is ultimately going to accomplish his purpose. But in this specific situation, he's not absolutely certain. So at each step of the way, he's getting confirmation that God is leading just by the circumstances, but he's not overreading them. He's not assuming at any point that he has the definitive answer. So even here, when after he's told this story, after he's experienced this himself, and then he's told the story, and he's made it very clear that so far it seems clear that God has been leading and that God has in fact appointed Rebekah to be Isaac's wife, and that seems clear according to the circumstances around him, he passes the ball over to Laban and Bethuel, and he says, okay, now the ball is in your court. And whatever you decide, I need to know what you're going to decide, so that, he says, if you decide that I can't, then I can turn to the right or left. I'll go somewhere else. I'll do something else. I'll figure out plan B. if you say no, okay? And so, yeah, I think in answer to your question, that's to some degree what he's doing, is he's giving them a signal that he's not presuming to make their decision for them. It's a decision they're going to have to make for themselves. Okay? Anything else? Kind of got carried away on that answer.
It was interesting to me. They set up the feast, but he refused to eat.
Okay. That's real interesting to me, too, because I'd eat first. But he has a priority, doesn't he? And his priority is his master's work. It's the job that the master has given him to do, and that's his priority. And he's going to focus on that first. Okay? Well, let's pick up the story then in verse 50 and find out how Laban and Bethuel respond, and ultimately how Rebekah responds, because that's where we left it last week. Then Laban and Bethuel replied, "The matter comes from the Lord, so we cannot speak to you, good or bad or good. Here is Rebekah before you. Take her and go, and let her be the wife of your master's son, as the Lord has spoken." When Abraham's servant heard these words, he bowed himself to the ground before the Lord. The servant brought out articles of silver and articles of gold and garments and gave them to Rebekah. He also gave precious things to her brother and to her mother. Then he and the men who were with him ate and drank and spent the night. When they arose in the morning, he said, "Send me away to my master." But her brother and her mother said, "Let the girl stay with us a few days, say 10. Afterwards she may go." He said to them, "Do not delay me, since the Lord has prospered my way. Send me away that I may go to my master." And they said, "We will call the girl and consult her wishes." Then they called Rebekah and said to her, "Will you go with this man?" And she said, "I will go." Thus they sent away their sister Rebekah and her nurse with Abraham's servant and his men. They blessed Rebekah and said to her, "May you, our sister, become thousands of 10,000s, and may your descendants possess the gate of those who hate them." Then Rebekah arose with her maids, and they mounted the camels and followed the man. So the servant took Rebekah and departed. Now Isaac had come from going to Beer Lahai-Roi, for he was living in the Negev. Isaac went out to meditate in the field toward evening, and he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, camels were coming. Rebekah lifted up her eyes, and when she saw Isaac, she dismounted from the camel. She said to the servant, "Who is that man walking in the field to meet us?" And the servant said, "He is my master." And she took her veil and covered herself. The servant told Isaac all the things that he had done. Then Isaac brought her into his mother Sarah's tent, and he took Rebekah, and she became his wife, and he loved her. Thus Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. Okay? Well, so the ball, as I say, is passed over to Laban and Bethuel. And they respond. And they say, "Well, this matter is from the Lord. We can't say anything bad or good. So here's Rebekah, you take her and let her be Isaac's wife." And as we look at this response of Laban and Bethuel, actually several questions come to mind on the surface. As we read it kind of superficially, it might seem like a very nice spiritual answer, but in reality there are some problems here with their answer. Okay, the first thing I want to point out, and we mentioned a little bit about this last week, was they refer here again to the Lord. It says this matter is from the Lord. We need to understand that they're not speaking from the context of ones who are worshipers of God. Okay, we've already established that. They don't worship God. They worship idols. And if they do have any knowledge of or recognition of Yahweh, it's only of Yahweh as a God among many gods. Okay, so in their acknowledgement here that this matter is from Yahweh, they're not recognizing Yahweh as the sovereign Lord of the universe and the one to whom all of us owe our worship and allegiance. They're simply recognizing that this God, Yahweh, whoever he is among all the gods, has clearly expressed what he wants done here, and we're not going to mess with it. Okay? And that's the idea of their expression here. So when they say, we're not, you know, he's expressed his will so that we can't say anything bad or good. Again, on the surface, it might sound like, well, wow, that's pretty impressive. They're not going to argue with God. But in reality, I think that's a pretty feeble answer. Okay. And it's interesting that within the context, it comes out how weak their answer really is. And when I say in the context, I mean when we see the response of the servant. Because after they give their answer, which, as I maintain, is a fairly insipid answer, a fairly weak answer, after they give their answer, what is the servant's response? Before that.
Oh, before that one?
Before he brings the gifts. What's the first thing he does after they say yes? He bows to the ground. Okay, this is the second time we see him worshiping. Okay, so he bows to the ground and he worships. Now, it is interesting here that when we saw him do that earlier at the well with Rebecca, it actually tells us what he said. But here it doesn't tell us what his prayer was. It doesn't tell us what he articulated in worship. And I think that the reason it tells us in the first instance is because what he said had significance to Rebecca. But here it doesn't tell us what he said because it had no significance to Laban and Bethuel. It didn't matter to them what he said. Okay. But what is interesting to me here is the response of the servant. Now, when a worshiper of God can clearly see God's hand and God's direction in a circumstance, what is the normal response? Worship, right? What do we see with Laban and Bethuel? It's fatalism, isn't it? It's a fatalism. It's a, well, you know, we don't have any say in this, you know. So it sounds good. You know, we could never say anything good or bad about what God is doing. But that's not the response of a believer. When a believer sees the hand of God at work, he always has something good to say, doesn't he? He always has something good to say. And even when God's hand is sometimes difficult, and God's leading is difficult, and He's leading us through difficult circumstances, when we see that it's Him that's leading us, it evokes from our hearts worship. But what we see with Laban and Bethuel is this kind of fatalism that just says, well, God's just going to do whatever He's going to do, and it doesn't matter what I think about it. And so, just let God do what He's going to do, and we'll go along with it, and we'll cooperate with whatever He's planning to do here. But when it really comes down to it, it really doesn't matter what we think. And I think there's a couple things about that. One is that kind of a response, which I have at times seen in myself and seen in other believers, that kind of response is very unbecoming. Certainly unbecoming to one who purports or claims to worship God. Okay? When we see God's hand at work, we owe Him not only our obedience, but we owe Him that expression of praise that says, God, what You are doing is good. And that's what's missing in Laban and Bethuel. The second thing is, I think the reality is, they really didn't like the idea. That their response comes from not only their lack of a sense of awe or respect or reverence for Yahweh, but as we'll see, I think there are some reservations. Okay, there is in the back of their mind kind of a, I'm not sure about this, and that'll become clear as we go through the passage. Okay, I hope it'll become clear anyway.
Rick, you know what you're describing there is really seen all throughout the world with Christians having a personal relationship with God, and when they say Him act, and they get their attitude correct and respond the way you describe, then they'll be thankful or whatever, even if they don't understand it. But people who are not in that kind of relationship
And like these guys, they saw the same police. The response is, well, that must be what God wants. And,
yeah.
But they didn't have any personal relationship, and probably never had in any of their dealings with their God.
They yeah.
See it.
Yeah.
And so there is no, you know, they're just like a sailboat out in the, without a rudder. Just, you know,
yep. Just wherever the wind blows. Yeah.
Wherever
it
goes.
Yeah.
Now, well, yeah. I guess that's all we do.
Yeah.
But you would think that they, at the very end of the story, and seeing God's hand at work, that at least they would be interested in getting to know this God, Abraham.
You would think, wouldn't you? And so, and yet, oftentimes we see. Oh, excuse, what were you going to say?
I think that today,
yeah.
People go,
yeah,
maybe more.
Yeah, it's so obvious. Why can't you see it?
It's kind of like what Jesus says about casting your pearls before swine, isn't it? That some of the things that are most precious to us, some of the things that are most wonderful to us, when we share them with an unbeliever, it's yeah, it's coincidence, or you know, or. Or so, you know, big deal. You know. And it's because they're not in that personal relationship with a loving, covenant-keeping God. Okay? And that's what makes the difference. And so they really don't appreciate the wonder and the glory of what it means to walk with God and to have God intervene in our lives and providentially direct our lives. You know? And so that's one of the things about providence is when God is providentially working in our lives, if we don't have eyes of faith, it's so easy to see things just as circumstance. And that's the wonderful transformation that comes in Rebecca's heart. As she gets up that morning and she goes about her business and she grabs that jar for water and she puts it on her shoulder and she goes out to the well, it's just everyday life to her. But within a matter of an hour or so, she comes to the realization that it isn't everyday life. And that there is a covenant-keeping, compassionate, loving, almighty God who is intimately involved in when she picks up a jar of water. And that's pretty earth-shattering when you come to realize that. But most of the world lives without that awareness and without any appreciation of that awareness and of that reality. Well, so they concede then, they agree or assent to Rebecca going, but you notice I just want to point out, and this will come out more as we go along. It's just there. It's Laban's and Bethuel's decision, right? The whole thing is laid before them, and they respond, and the decision is made. There's been no consultation with Rebecca, and noticeably, there's been no consultation with Rebecca's mother. Okay, so that'll all come into play here in just a bit. So then, having then worshipped, then what does he do? The servant do? Before he eats. I know you guys are anxious to get that meal. I am too. But before he does that, brings out the gifts. Okay, so he brings out these. He's already given her the bracelet and the nose ring. Okay, but now he brings out these other articles of silver, it says, and articles of gold and clothing. And you can only imagine the beauty and the splendor of these gifts that he has brought. You know, I'm sure if I were the servant and I were picking the things to take in that circumstance, I would find the best things I could possibly find. You know. I wouldn't pick just myself. I'd go to my wife and I'd say, what kind of dress should I take for this lady, you know? And so anyway, he comes and he brings these elaborate, expensive, precious things to give to her. And then he also gives precious gifts to her brother Laban, and he gives precious gifts to the mother. And then finally, folks, what does he do? This is what you've been waiting for, right? He sits down and eats. Okay. So they go ahead and they eat and they drink. By now it's probably quite late at night. Remember, he came to the well early in the evening. So have all these things that have gone on, the watering of the camels and then going to the home and then the provision for the camels and telling the whole story again and everything. So it's really probably gotten quite late at night and they're probably quite ready for bed by the time comes. And so it simply tells us that they spent the night and the next thing we see, it's morning, and the events of the morning unfold. But let's don't hurry past that night. Let's use a little bit of sanctified imagination and think about that night. you know, I can imagine what's going on with the servant and his men. They've traveled all day. They've been through this fairly intense negotiation or meeting with Laban's family. They're exhausted, and they lay down their heads on the pillow and they go to sleep. But what do you think's going on with Laban's family? Yeah, Mama finally gets her say. It doesn't say anything about it, but I can just about imagine, you know, once she gets Laban aside, she goes, "Son, what did you just do?" You know, I, again, I'm reading between the lines there, and we don't know what she said, but you can only imagine the kind of discussions going on in the household of Bethuel and Laban that night while the servant is fast asleep, and we see the effects of it the next morning, okay? That by the time the morning rolls around, they're having second thoughts, okay? And that'll unfold as we go forward. But you can imagine that discussion going on there and over, you know, in Laban's part of the household. What do you think's going on with Rebecca?
She's looking at all the stuff she got. But then she's going through the back of her mind.
Well, the excitement, too, as a young woman, knowing that she's probably getting ready to be married and thinking about the man that she's never seen. What is he like? What is his family really like? What is the land like? I'll be leaving my family. You know, I'm sure you
can. It's not around the block.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you can imagine. I have a suspicion she didn't get a lot of sleep that night. Yeah. But remember, there's something else. She's thinking about this guy, and she, you know, this man. She's thinking about all these things you mentioned. But she's also discovered something glorious and wonderful this evening. What she's discovered: the living God. And she's discovered that the living God has His hand on her life. I mean, that's so incomprehensible. We just take it for granted. We live that way every day as believers, don't we? And we just take it for granted. But what is it like for the very first time, that very first night, you wake up and you realize that there is a living, sovereign, covenant-keeping God who is intimately and lovingly involved in my life and cares about my life and cares about my future and cares about my destiny and has been sovereignly, providentially directing the affairs of my life to draw me to Himself. I can't imagine Rebecca got much sleep that night as she contemplated those things. And I have no doubt she was contemplating them. Rick.
It's a lot more difficult when daughters get married than sons do. Because you're handing, as a father, you're handing the girl over that authority and protection and cover.
You're losing a little bit of say in your life, aren't you?
It's something you want to be careful about.
Yeah.
I can sympathize.
Absolutely. Yeah, with Laban and with her mother. I mean, you put it in context, like you say, Rick, you know, all these things you mentioned that Rebecca's thinking, they're thinking too. She's going off to a strange land. We don't know this guy. You know, I mean, he is a relative, but remember, he's that crazy uncle, you know. He's the son of that crazy uncle. And, you know, and so they're thinking all those things. They don't know all those, you know, and they love her. You know, there's no doubt they loved her and they cared for her.
I'm thinking Stephen had put a ring and Randy.
different culture, huh? What were you going to say, Ruth?
Especially in the time frame that this happened, women had no rights or anything they couldn't speak up.
Yeah.
Girls today go out and get a job.
Yeah.
But these women were totally dependent on
their. Absolutely. And so we can sympathize with them and sympathize with them even more since they don't know God. Since they don't know this covenant-keeping, loving, compassionate, involved God. So they're operating in the context of the world, in a context in which gods are manipulated and controlled and carved out of wood. And, you know, that's the context they're coming from. And so so it is true. We ought to give some sense of at least empathy and sympathy to them in the circumstances.
I think you almost wonder with the delay of explaining this, they want to cut a better deal. You know, we can get more We need to have a better view.
Okay.
I have a quite different perspective than what you two guys have.
Well, we haven't even gotten there yet. At least let me get there.
I'm anticipating. It's already been mentioned that they're wanting to have a better deal than Jim said, or you're thinking that they didn't really like it. This very thing happened to me and my wife and my daughter. This exact story. Even down to the part in verse 67 where my son-in-law lost his mother. And so now, you know, he's being comforted in the same kind of regard. So a lot of these parallels are really striking to me whenever I read through the story. And I had preparations to send my daughter away. And it was still very difficult.
Yeah.
But they had no preparations.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking from my perspective. Now, you guys may be right. I don't know. Yeah. Maybe they do want a better deal. But from my perspective, when I read it, they're saying, well, I'm not ready for her to go. Let's visit a little longer. Let's talk about some stuff we need to talk about. Or, you know, let's, you know, whatever they want to do. And then, you know, let's stay a little bit longer. You know, hang around. I really like you to be around. Don't go yet. You know,
well, and that's the... You missed out on the nose ring. Well, that is a good point, and those are things we need to think about. So let's move forward to the next morning. The servant gets up the next morning and he says, please send me to my master. Now, I don't know whether he gave any indication the night before that he was planning to pack bags the next morning. But, you know, I would assume he probably gave some indication to that effect, but we don't know. So we'll just leave that well enough alone. And he says, please send me to my master. It's very clear he cannot leave without Laban's agreement. Okay, and within the, you have to understand the cultural context here again and think about the context of the situation. You know, when you go to visit somebody, you pretty much decide when you're going to leave and you just leave and you don't really ask their permission to leave. But this is a different situation here, okay? He's leaving with their daughter, okay? He's leaving with his brother, I mean, his sister. And not only that, but it's just the servant and his helpers, okay? The guys that are with him. They're not really equipped in any way to defend themselves or to protect themselves. So if Laban has no intention of letting them go, they can't go. Secondly, they're getting ready to make a 3-week journey. They, you know, they need provision. They need things for their camels. They need food. They need the kind of things to be able to make this journey back home. So they need provision. So he really does need the assent. He needs the agreement and the cooperation of Laban to leave. So he comes to Laban and he says, please, you know, let me send me off to my master. Give me the provisions. Give me the protection that I need to be able to leave and to take your sister and to go back to my master. And it's at this point, then, that Laban says, well, now, why don't you hang around a while, okay? And it, and like Jim says, it sounds like a perfectly acceptable request. You know, I mean, here this guy shows up at night. You know, the decision is made that night. You know, there's all the... As you can imagine, all the discussion that's going on in Laban's household late into the night with Mama and all that sort of stuff going on. And there's no chance to say goodbye. There's no chance to sit around and reminisce and talk about the future and talk about, you know, exchange email addresses. And all that. There's no time to do all that. Okay, he just wants to pack up his bags and go. And it seems like a perfectly reasonable request. In fact, it seems as reasonable as the request of the man to whom Jesus said in Luke chapter 9, follow me. And he said, please, let me go and say goodbye to my family. And Jesus said, if any man sets his hand to the plow and looks back, he's not worthy to be a disciple of mine. Or the other man to whom Jesus said, follow me. And he said, please let me go bury my father and then I will come and follow you. I think it sounds like a perfectly reasonable request on the surface. But the first thing, do you notice how he says it? What exactly is he asking for? Precisely, what is he asking for?
That makes it up to take about morning.
No, I mean, what is Laban asking for? What is Laban asking for?
But the girl staying with her for 2 days.
Uh-huh. What precisely is he asking for? There is no preciseness, is there?
Mm-hmm.
You notice that? He doesn't say, give us 3 days. Give us 10 days. He says, and if you read this in various translations, it's translated various ways in the different translations. And the reason is because it's ambiguous. It's ambiguous. It's open-ended. It's, let her stay a few days. Maybe 10 is the way it translates it here in the New American. Okay, and the idea is, and actually, the way the phrase is worded, it could even be translated, let her stay maybe 10 years. Okay. Now, obviously, that's not what he's asking because he knows what kind of a response he would get for that. But the point is, it's an ambiguous time. Because what he's doing here is he's trying to buy time. He's trying to buy time. And it doesn't say it. I'm reading between the lines here. But I think the reason he's trying to buy time is because he's running into the saw blade of his mother's displeasure. You just sold off my daughter without even consulting me, and she's going to leave this morning. And certainly they want time to say goodbye. But the problem is that they want time to say goodbye, and I think in reality, and I'll show you by the way things unfold here in a minute, that I really think what he really is hoping for is a way out of the situation. Now, as we'll discover as we look at Laban later in Genesis, we'll find out this is a habit of his. That he opens his mouth and he makes a commitment, and then later on down the road he feels the need to change it. Okay, so he's a guy who goes back on his word. This is our first indication or hint that this may be the case with him. But we'll see that this really is a characteristic of his. That he makes a promise and then he thinks better of it later and tries to go back on his word. So he's
caught up in all the things he brought out.
Well, I think, quite honestly, he saw that it was the hand of God. He didn't think all this much of God, but he thought it was the hand of God, and initially he made the right decision. The problem was he started having second thoughts about it. And it's just like the guy who Jesus calls to be his disciple, and he wants to do it. That's the right decision. Yeah, I want to do it, but let me go say goodbye to my family first. And you see, what's at play here is it's not just a matter of this girl's going to get married, and it's not really critical whether the marriage date is now or a week from now. That's not what's at stake here. What's at stake here is the call of God. This is the call of God on Rebecca. And it has become clear now to the servant that this is the call of God. Which is why he responds to Laban's request the way he does. Because he says in verse 56, he said to them, do not delay me, since the Lord has prospered my way. What is he saying there? Well, there's two things he's saying there. One is he's saying, okay, now it's pretty clear, folks. This is God doing this. And God's hand in this is in this. And this is God's call on Rebecca. And when God calls, we do not delay. When God says, this is what I want, we don't procrastinate. We don't say, let me go bury my father. We don't say, let me go say goodbye to my family. When God calls, we obey. Yes, Rick?
He also probably knew that his master was waiting there.
Of course he did. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. The second thing about his remark here about this being of the Lord is it really is kind of a veiled threat, isn't it? He's saying to Laban, now Laban, we all agreed last night, this is God's thing. And I suspect here that the servant is detecting in Laban's second thoughts. And so he just wants Laban to know, if you back out on this, you're messing with God. He doesn't threaten him. He just reminds him of what Laban knew so well the night before. So oftentimes what's easy for us is we hear the call of God in our life. We hear what God calls us to do. We see the standard that He sets. And initially we respond in our exuberance of the moment and we say, yes, Lord, I'll do this or I'll... But then we have a night to sleep on it and we start having second thoughts and we remember all the problems and the difficulties with obeying God and we start having second thoughts. And that's the moment we need to remember that first... those first thoughts, those that first impression we had when we knew God was working and God was leading and God was directing in our lives. It really is a serious thing when God is called and we delay. And so I do think, with all due respect to your point, Jim, and I think it is a valid point, I think this is a unique situation. This is a special situation because this is very clearly the call of God. This is similar, almost identical, to the call that God gave to Abraham in chapter 12. It comes in a different way. To Abraham, it came directly through the voice of God. So it comes in a different way. It comes in a different form. But it is essentially the same thing. God is saying to Rebecca to leave her country and to leave her family and to leave her father's house and go to a land that she does not know, to a land that He will show her and to a family that He will show her. And you can't help but have come to your mind that wonderful story of Ruth. When Ruth is following her mother-in-law, and they get to that inn or that khan there in Moab on their way back to Israel, and her mother-in-law is trying to encourage her to go back to Moab. You don't understand. I have nothing for you. You go back to Moab. And what does Ruth say? She says, I'm going to go with you, and where you lodge, I will lodge, and your God will be my God, and your people will be my people. And she just says, I'm throwing my lot in with you. I'm not going back. And this is the point that we see Rebecca coming to. But there's a problem. And the problem is that Rebecca has never really been given a choice in this matter, has she? Do you notice that? She's not been given any choice. And so actually, this is a case of the wrath of man serving the Lord. Okay? This is a case of Laban's folly and Laban's foolishness and Laban's reluctance and Laban's second thoughts giving Rebecca the opportunity to make the choice she has to make. You see that? Now, everything I've said about Laban and Laban having second thoughts and all of it, you have to kind of so far take that kind of for granted because I haven't proven my case yet. But I think the next point will prove my case. What does he tell his sister when he calls his sister? What does he ask her? Will you go with this man? What's wrong with that question? Okay. He'd already said he should go. Okay. And what really is the issue that supposedly she was being called to resolve? Whether she stays for 10 days or not. Or some ambiguous amount of time. Okay. That was the question to which she was supposedly being called to answer for. But when she gets there into the room and they ask, Laban says, will you go with this man?
Well, that doesn't make sense because the answer is obviously we're going to get up and go. So I think, I'm sorry to disagree with you again. I think even though it's only stated that way, I think she knew the implication is that we're leaving.
Oh, I know she understood that they were leaving now. But the question that Laban puts to her is not the question, are you willing to stay?
Right.
The question he puts to her, are you willing to go?
Well, the reason I think that is because ultimately it was not God's call upon Laban and the family. It was God's call on Rebecca. And so Laban and them were trying to answer something. They were part of it because they were the family, but it wasn't a call on them. It was a call
Which is exactly my point.
Right.
That's exactly my point is that Laban's hesitancy and Laban's second thoughts were necessary in order to create the situation. Is that my phone? Teresa's phone. Everybody's answering their phone here in the room. Okay. Now we know whose phone it is. So the point is that in a sense it was necessary for Laban to back off a little bit. In order for the decision about whether or not she would go to be Rebecca's. You see that? It comes to a point, what God is doing is, he's providentially working even through the wrath of man, if you will. He's even working providentially through Laban's second thoughts. He's working providentially to create a situation where it is clear to us that Rebecca is choosing to marry Isaac. It's not simply her husband's or her brother's decision, because as Jim points out, it wasn't their decision to make. It was Rebecca's decision to make. Because when it comes down to an issue of whether or not I'm going to obey God, it's not my parents' decision. And it's not my brother's decision or my sister's decision or my wife's decision or my children's decision. When it comes down to whether or not I'm going to respond to the call of God, it's my decision. And I have to decide. And that's what Rebecca does. The decision is given to her. And like her descendant, like Ruth, many, many, many years later, she makes that decision. I'm going to go, and they're going to be my people, and he's going to be my God. And she makes that choice at that point. She responds to the call of God in her life.
That just has any significance. Like in verse 8, when Abraham sent the servant, he said, if a woman's not willing to follow you, you'll be released from this oath. But in verse 41, when he tells the family, he says, if they will not give her to you, you'll be released from my oath.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Yeah, I hadn't noticed that difference there. That is interesting, yeah. Say it again.
As this poor evidence that God handles on that, because later he said, she can go with you, and then the next step had to be the woman.
Yeah. So it really had to be both of them. Yeah, it had to be both of them. In the culture, it had to be both. But before the Lord, it had to be Rebecca, didn't it? It had to be Rebecca. She had to make the choice. And so God orchestrates through the culture and through the circumstances. And ultimately, then, Rebecca does make the decision. Now, it is possible that had we never gotten to this crisis point here, had we never gotten to the point where Rebecca had to respond, it's still possible that she would have gone, and she would have gone willingly and gladly and in faith. But it's that the circumstances that did unfold with Laban and with his mother and her mother, that those circumstances afford for us an opportunity that we see Rebecca's faith. You see, we would never have known Rebecca's faith. It might have been there, but we would never have seen it. Like we see it so clearly here when she says, I will go. I am choosing. I am gladly going to be a part of this process. I'm gladly going to go and embrace this man to be my husband. And I'm going to embrace his God. And I'm going to worship Yahweh. And I'm going to become a part of this covenant promise. And we see that and we know that. And oftentimes, I was thinking about that in our lives, oftentimes we chafe, don't we, under the burden of living with unbelievers who respond around us in unchristian ways, or even sometimes Christians who respond to us. And we chafe under that, and we go, oh Lord, why? But you see, it was Laban's response here that gave Rebecca the opportunity to display her faith. And it gave Rebecca an opportunity to display her confidence in this sovereign covenant-keeping God. And in our lives, it's those negative situations. It's those people in our lives who make life hard for us. And the people in our lives who may not respond in Christian ways and in godly ways and create circumstances in our lives they are the opportunities that we have to show how much we love God and how much we value Him and how much we honor Him. So it's those It's those negative circumstances that give us the opportunity to display our faith that we might not otherwise have. Now, there's probably many other opportunities we would have, but this just gives us more, doesn't it? And it's kind of like the illustration one guy gave one time that a diamond is most beautiful when it's placed on a black background. Oftentimes, when you see diamonds displayed, they're displayed on black fabric. Why is that? Because that's what displays their beauty. And so oftentimes the faith and the hope in our own lives is only displayed when it's displayed against a very black background.
So you're saying thankful for those people.
I think we should be thankful that in all things God works all things to good for those who love Him. Well, and so she goes, and she gets up and she goes with the servant. She chooses and she goes. And then it just skips all the way to the Negev. Okay, but let's just, you know, we spent a moment just thinking imagination about that night. It skipped over. Let's do that now about that journey. 21 days, 3 weeks, riding a camel down the King's Highway, stopping and camping every night. Remember Rebecca? Remember what she's like? Remember her personality? What do you think's going on?
She's organized.
She's organizing it. Well, that may be true. She may be doing that. But what are they doing during those long hours of clomping along on the back of a camel? Huh?
I think they're talking about.
Yeah, they're talking. Can you imagine the third degree that servant's getting? Can you imagine? What we probably had in that 3 week journey back to the Negev, what we probably had is a 3 week study in the life of Abraham. As he had the opportunity, the servant had the opportunity to tell her the whole story of Abraham from when he left Haran the first time, when he arrived in Canaan, Shechem and Bethel and Negev, and all the stories, and the stories about Lot, and all those things that we've been studying for the last 6, 7, 8 months, however long we've been studying it, how they must have talked about all those things. And those repeated appearances of God to Abraham. How her father-in-law is a man who had actually seen God and talked to God. And that remarkable story of Moriah, that her husband willingly was going to allow himself to be sacrificed in obedience to God, and how God interposed and provided a ram in his place. All those stories they must have talked about. And then they arrive at the Negev, and the spotlight switches now, just kind of almost abruptly, it switches to Isaac. And you notice it says he has just been to Beer Lahai-Roi. What is that? What is Beer Lahai-Roi? We've encountered it before. See, you never know when these obscure names are going to come back up. You've got to remember them. You remember what that is? It's a place. It's a place. It's not a piece of land, but it's a place. Pardon? No. No. It's Hagar's well. Remember Hagar? Remember that first time when she fled, right after she got pregnant, and she fled and she encountered God? And then after God said, you know, I'm going to save you and you're going to have a baby and all that sort of thing, and then she lifted up her eyes and she saw a well of water. That's the well. And she called it, or it's called, it says, Beer Lahai-Roi, meaning the well of the God who sees. And it just mentions that Isaac has been there. It doesn't tell us why. It doesn't tell us what he was doing there. But he had just come back from there. And you wonder, why does it say that? Well, apparently, it's put there to give us some context. Okay. And he's come back. And then after he's come back from Beer Lahai-Roi, what is he doing? What do we find him doing? He's meditating. He's gone out in the field to meditate. This is Isaac. Okay, this is kind of a picture of Isaac's personality. Okay, but he's a contemplator. He's a meditator. He's a thinker. And he's gone out to walk. Well, I can relate to Isaac here. I can't think unless I'm walking. You set me in a chair at home to meditate, and I'll be fast asleep. I can't think unless I saw. If I want to think, I got to get up off my feet and go outdoors and go for a walk, and then I can think. Okay, so I'm like Isaac, and in that one respect. So Isaac is out meditating. What's he meditating about? Well, he's just come from Beer LaHaroy, and so you kind of have to put the pieces of the puzzle together. But it appears that, and there's reason why we conclude this, but it appears that he's just thinking about his life. If he's been at Beer LaHaroy, he's been contemplating the circumstances of his beginnings and that whole ugly situation with Hagar and the fact that he has a half-brother, and you know, and he's thought about all that stuff. All that stuff has been brought to his mind because he's just been to that well. For whatever reason he was there, he's been there, and all those things have been brought. And then without a doubt, he's thought about how jealously his mother has guarded his heritage. That she wouldn't have any part of Hagar or Ishmael having any part of his inheritance, and how vigorously and jealously she has guarded. And it must have been that his affections towards his mother have been aroused by this visit to Beer LaHaroy. Why do I say that? Because of what it says at the end, that he was comforted after the death of his mother. And so you see him out in the field and he's meditating, and that word too is a word that has a variety of ways it can be translated. And so some people say he was praying, and some people say he was meditating, and some people say he was complaining to the Lord, because it can have that idea. And maybe it has all those kinds. Maybe it has all those meanings there. Maybe all of that was going on in Isaac's heart. But certainly one of the things that he's thinking about is, what's going on with that servant of my dad's? And then he looks up and he sees the camels coming. And he goes off to meet the camels. And at that same moment, Rebecca looks up from her camel and she sees this man coming to her. And it says she fell off her camel. It says she dismounted. But actually the word could be translated fall. Okay. I don't think she fell. But the idea is she got off that camel in a hurry. Okay. She got off that camel in a hurry. She got down. She says, "Who is this guy coming?" as if she didn't know. And he says, "It's my master." And she covers herself with a veil, which is, of course, the customary attire of a bride-to-be. She covers herself with a veil. And the servant, and Isaac comes to the servant, and the servant tells the story. Now, you notice he doesn't repeat, the narrator doesn't repeat the story for us here. We lucked out here, didn't we? We didn't get a third telling of the story here, right? Okay. Why doesn't he tell it? Well, I think what that does is it illustrates for us the significance of the first repeat. That it was important to repeat the story that first time when he was in Laban's house for the narrator to repeat that for us, because we needed to think about how it was impacting Rebecca, because this was her first encounter with the living God. This is not Isaac's first encounter with the living God. For Isaac, this is the normal Christian life. He has lived as the son of his father, and he's seen God providentially directing in his whole life. This is just normal stuff for him. So the servant tells the story, and then Isaac takes this woman to be his wife. He takes her into his mother's tent, and there he marries her, and he takes her for his wife, and it says he loves her. Now, whatever else we read about the story of Isaac and Rebekah in the future, just remember he loves her. Just remember that. Because they're going to have some rough times in their marriage. But he loves her. I think he loves her just because he loves her. But I think he loves her also because this woman has made a heroic step of faith, just like his dad. That she gave up everything. We see in Rebecca that pattern of being a disciple, don't we? Self-denial, the walk of faith, the hope and the promise. And we see that in Rebecca. And Isaac sees that in Rebecca. Here is a woman who has given up everything to come and be my wife and to worship my God and to partake in the promise that I am a partaker in. And then lastly, he loves her because she is the woman whom God has brought to her, just in the same way that God brought Eve to Adam. And he recognizes that. And he sees that this woman is to him a gift from God. And so he loves her. And their life begins together. Next week we'll close out the story of Abraham and we'll pick up with the story of Isaac and Rebekah. Okay?